Sometimes I feel the weight of the world fall down on me. And I need a friendly voice with some good theology. Calvinistically speaking, though I mix a manly drink, Pepsi and shoe polish, and I hit the YouTube link. Don't say hit, that sounds violent. And I feel my troubles all melt away. Oh, oh, oh. It's your Calvinist podcast with Keith Bossy.
Your Calvinist podcast is filmed before a live studio audience.
And welcome everyone to Your Calvinist podcast. My name is Keith Foskey and I am your Calvinist. It's good to have you on the show with me today. And before I bring in my guest, I do have a few housekeeping issues that I like to get out of the way right in front. First of all, I want to remind you again about my friends over at 1689 Cigars. They're giving a special for anyone who makes a purchase using the coupon code Superior Theology. And if you're watching this show, I hope you have Superior Theology. Go and get yourself your new cigars from them and use that coupon code and you will get a percentage off. I want to also remind you that this show is part of the ministry of Sovereign Grace Family Church. So if you're in the Jacksonville area and you're looking for a church, come visit us at Sovereign Grace Family Church and you can look us up online at sgfcjax.org. Now, Sovereign Grace is a Reformed Baptist Church. And what that means is that we are part of the history of the Baptist movement, which began in the 17th century as part of the Calvinistic wing of the Baptist movement. And some people say, well, you're Baptist, so you're not truly Reformed. So today we're going to be talking a little bit about what it means to be Reformed. We're going to talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly of Reformed Christian subculture. And who better to talk about that with me than my good friend and now friend of the show, Michael Foster. Michael, thank you for being on the show with me today.
Thanks for having me, man. I love that intro. That's a 80s throwback.
Yeah, it's exactly what I asked for. Hans Feeney at Lutheran Satire wrote it and performed it for me. And he asked me what I wanted. I said, I love the 80s. He said, you want 80s hairband or 80s TV show? I said, 80s TV show. And he did, and he came through really, really strong. And so we filmed the video to go with it after he made the song. So it all worked out. So I know you, and I want to say something very quickly to my audience. I want to thank you personally, Michael. Just a few days ago, I guess it's been a couple of weeks now, I reached out to you. I had a question about something and you said, hey man, call me. And you talked with me for an hour and a half. I was on a drive home. I was driving home from the Y Calvinism conference in Tullahoma, Tennessee. And man, you spent an hour and a half on the phone with me, just talking about being a pastor, being a father, just life. And man, I came home. I felt great. It actually was uplifting, not just that day, but for a few days afterwards, I was like, man, that a lot of what you said really resonated with me. So thank you for that right away. I just want to say that that was very pastoral.
Well, thank you. Feelings mutual. It was a good conversation.
Awesome, brother. So for my audience members who don't know who you are, can you tell us just a little bit of who you are? And I know you're an author, you're a pastor, you're a conference speaker. You're also quite a Twitter aficionado. So tell everyone a little bit about you who might not know who you are.
I'm a pastor in terms of what I do vocationally. I'm a bivocational pastor. So I work as a sales director for a company. And then also I pastor East River Church, which is we're about 3 years old. We're out here in Batavia, Ohio, which is just outside of Cincinnati, and around 400 people-ish these days, and just growing. It's exciting. I've been married to my wife, Emily, for over 20 years. We have had 8 kids together with the 9th on the way at the end of next month. So I think it's a girl. So we're actually going to be 5 girls, 4 boys. But then I've been involved in kind of internet culture that I don't really talk about this very often, but given the context of what we're going to talk about today, it might be relevant. I was absolutely fascinated by the Boxing Day tsunami when it happened. So I think that's 2004, Christmas 2004. And that was back then, YouTube still wasn't owned by Google. And there was a bunch of other like kind of video platforms that you could share on. And so I started a blogger. I maybe had started a little earlier, and I created a page to put links to all these videos for the other people online that were obsessed with seeing the tsunami, because that was the first time that a big tsunami happened, and tons of people had handheld videos, and the videos got out. And then, so I got quite a following on that blog, and I wrote an article on why I hated Thomas Kinkade art. And I just thought Thomas Kinkade's terrible from an artistic point of view. That went viral. Like the second blog post I ever wrote went viral for a blogger back then. And so I immediately was kind of pulled into the New Calvinism movement through blogger and TypePad. Back then, Steve McCoy was a big blogger. Still remains an acquaintance of mine. I haven't talked to him in a while, but I met a lot of people back then that were kind of momentarily a big deal. Adrian Warnock was, everyone was talking about him back then. You don't hear about these guys anymore, but so I got put into that sort of online community, and I've been an early adopter on things like MySpace. My first church plant, we used MySpace to plant, and then I've been on Facebook forever, kind of doing my thing. But when I started, It's Good to Be a Man in 2018 officially. That's when things really started to take off for me, you know, and people started listening to the podcast that me and my friend Dominic Tennant did. And then we eventually wrote a book that was published by Canon Press that sold very well. So I've been kind of involved. When I was first on Twitter, I thought it was really terrible. I hated it. I just didn't understand it. So my early tweets are prime numbers and bones of the body. So I tweet out a prime number every day or a bone of the body. It's like it's all disconnected. It doesn't. But then when I wanted to reach kind of younger men and engage with them as I was researching for It's Good to Be a Man, that conversation was happening at that time on Reddit and Twitter. It's not really happening on Reddit at all anymore. And it still is pretty strong on Twitter. So that's how I got really involved in the social media scene. It's been for a long time, but it took off. But what I really do is I'm a pastor, and I use all the content I make for my congregation, and I just rework it and tweet it out. So a lot of the stuff I tweet out, I wrote like 10 years ago, you know? So just I'm not sitting in my office thinking, oh, this is gold. Every once in a while. But that's kind of who I am. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. Just, you know, if you scroll through your Twitter, and I have you pulled up here, I went back to February 15th. Cause that was when you posted the tweet that I mentioned. I mean, a lot of this stuff is great. So you're saying a lot of this just is stuff that comes out of either a sermon quote or something that you've said and you just posted, I mean, it gets a lot of engagement. A lot of people are. Yeah.
So I write 1,000 words every morning when I wake up, Monday through Friday. And then I write about 2,000 on Saturdays, and then about 1,000 on Sunday. That's been my habit for years. So I've got 3 books in different stages. I'm ADHD, you know, so I don't like to work on one project at once, but I'm always writing stuff. And then I have kind of my prioritized content, which is my sermon first, then our monthly men's meeting, congregational emails, and then the youth gathering that I teach twice a month. Derivative content comes out of that. So I just go, oh yeah, that's cool. That'll tweet. I'll cut and paste that. Or I'll turn that into a podcast, or I'll grab part of my sermon or part of it that'll get turned into a reel is just from the sermon. So I make the sermon the most important part of my week, and anything else I'm doing that's connected to my local church. And then out of that, I pull my content for that. And it's crazy. People say, oh, you spend so much time on Twitter. I don't spend much time at all. You can tell if people spend time on Twitter if they're arguing back and forth, right? So if you make more than 5 comments a day, right, maybe just spend a lot of time. That's about all I'll say in a couple words. I don't engage in those arguments and stuff. I don't. It's Twitter. It's not going to go anywhere. So yeah, that's how I do my content, and that way I can keep an online presence to send out flares to say, hey, there's other people out there that think these things and believe these things. You're not alone, but also not get my time totally dominated by what can turn into a time suck, you know?
Sure. I have people ask me that question a lot too. As a pastor, they say, oh, it looks like you spend a lot of time on social media. I say, well, look how many people I follow. I don't follow a ton of people. Yeah. I'm mostly there to post content, and it's not, I don't argue. Like you said, I don't spend time. I post stuff. People say ugly things about it. I mean, I've had guys really rip me apart for various things, being funny or different things. And I'm just like, I don't care. I'm going to do, you know, what I think is right. And I'm going to put out what I think is good. And I'll let people hash it out in the comments. I'm not there to defend myself. You know, I do have people that come to my defense, which is nice. It's like, I'll see somebody say something, you know, in my defense, and I'm like, well, that's gracious.
When you cross that 10K, that kind of 10K mark, on Twitter, you really start to have people that are really kind of go do the dirty work for you. It's kind of nice.
Yeah. I got my friends there. come to my rescue. Yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier the new Calvinism movement. You know, I got saved in 99. I became a pastor after having gone to seminary. I actually took over as pastor in 2006, and I was going through a period of reformation at that point. I had introduced Reformed theology in 04 while I was in seminary. But my seminary said, if you believe this, your church will never grow. It's going to destroy your church. You're going to be a heretic, all these things. So I was afraid of it, you know, for a while. Cause I mean, I was sort of force fed the idea that it was evil. Mm-hmm. And, but God led me into it anyway. And God showed me the truth of it in the scripture and the beauty of it. And so I would say I really adopted the term Reformed Calvinist around 2007, 2008 ish. And then it was in 2010 that our church name changed. We actually went through a what I call a real revival of theology and history and those things. And we went from being, I grew up in this church. It used to be part of the Disciples of Christ, which is the old, you know, Church of Christ restoration movement, that leftist movement. But then we became Sovereign Grace Family Church. So that was during all this new Calvinism. I remember there was a Time magazine article. It was like the top 10 trends in religion, and one of them was new Calvinism. But I didn't know what any of that was. I just know I was hearing guys like R.C. Sproul. I got a chance to meet him a few times. He lived 2 hours south of me, so I would get to go to his church. I got to meet, you know, Steve Lawson and all these other guys who were teaching these things. But I didn't know it was part of a movement. I didn't care. I was preaching. I mean, I had three sermons a week to prepare for, you know, and I didn't have time to care about a movement. I cared about the word. But I was still, you know, I just got on Twitter like 2 years ago. It's not even been a part of my life. And so you mentioning it being weird, I thought it was weird too. I didn't know what it.
Threaded Facebook comments take a long time to understand how the conversations. It's like your brain, it's almost like your brain's got to get broken so you can understand it. My wife's like, I don't know who's responding to who and how to respond. It's like, just got to do it for a long time and your brain stops working right, and then you're able to do it.
Yeah, that's a good thought. You got to get X brain, because it's not Twitter anymore. I won't call it X, but I'll call it X brain. So when you said you became or the new Calvinism movement came into your life, were you already a Calvinist theologically, or was that influential on you? Did guys like Kroll and others influence you?
So I got saved in 1997. I grew up an agnostic atheist. So I never belonged to a church or religion or anything like that. And I don't really ever remember seriously praying to God or believing in Jesus or anything like that. So my brother and my mother started going to church around that time, and I wouldn't go because I thought it was just for charlatans and for sheep and that sort of stuff. So then I do end up going through kind of a difficult period in my life, and then I attend a basketball tournament that was also this sort of outreach, and a guy preached the gospel, and I seriously went from, you know, death to life, darkness to light overnight, became a Christian. And that was I believe it was Friday or Saturday. I think it was a Friday. So I go into school on Monday. I went to public school, walk into the library and go to the card catalog, because I'm old enough that we had card catalogs, and go to Christian. And there was two books. There was only two books underneath Christianity. It was The Cross and the Switchblade by David Wilkerson and Augustine's Confessions. So then I take those two books. I read them that week. So I started with kind of a blend, to be quite honest. And so I start reading the Church Fathers. I've been reading the Church Fathers since I first got saved. So I've got a kid named Athanasius, a kid named Cademan, a kid named Cyprian, a daughter who passed away named Nicaea. I love church history. And so then I'm reading all that stuff and really Calvinistic in a lot of my assumptions, but I didn't know that world. You know, I had never really read the Bible before. And I ended up leaving the charismatic church that I was in because they made me a junior high youth pastor, and I taught in junior high youth group that you couldn't have women pastors. And the only reason I taught that is I was literally reading and teaching through 1 Timothy 2 for the first time in my life. And I got to this, and I was like, right here, it says that a woman shouldn't be a pastor. And they're like, but wait, my mom's a pastor, because we had women pastors at the church. And I was like, yeah, but I don't know what to tell you. It says she shouldn't be. She's got to step down. So I got removed. from there. I stayed in the church for a bit, but I ended up leaving. I actually left on good terms, and I went to a Calvary Chapel church over in Northern Kentucky. And they introduced me to Chesterton and Lewis, and I started reading all that stuff. And then I slowly became reformed through friends and books. So I never went through a cage stage. Like, I think the internet, the form of media really shapes people, because with the internet, you can at least act like an expert really quick, because it's hastily gained knowledge. So it's very cheap. Where books, you have to work for it. And books especially older books, require meditation, digestion, thought. And when you have friends who are Calvinists that actually preach the gospel and are evangelistic and full of joy, you don't think of them in the same way you would if you meet a lot of these guys online, kind of the stereotype or whatever. So through reading Calvin's commentaries, I slowly became what you'd call a Calvinist. And then that around that time, I was really frustrated with, I left Calvary Chapel on good terms again, but they're very anti-Calvinistic. And I ended up at a PCUSA church. And it was a fairly conservative as the PCUSA went back then. That was 2004. And I got introduced around that time to Ian Murray, who wrote like mm-hmm. Revival and Revivalism, Puritan Hope and all that. So I bought all Murray's books and read all of those. And, and then I ended up becoming what you would call a kind of a Reformed Baptist, I guess. But I was more Reformed and Baptistic than a Reformed Baptist. So in other words, like time and a mode wasn't a big part of my identity. It was this kind of a happenstance of being saved in a non-denom charismatic church. But I was really frustrated with how weak the churches were and the lack of good preaching. And I was like, man, I just want a church that actually reaches men, that preaches, that doesn't grow through transfer growth alone, but also like makes disciples of local people. And I don't know where there's anything like this. And a friend of mine had just gone back from Seattle. He says, dude, I know a guy, you got to check out this guy. Just met him. His name's Mark. And so he hands me this binder. He just got him back from an Acts 29 boot camp in 2004. And so I read that and reach out to Acts 29. And I come into Acts 29 through Matt Chandler's church in 2005 and planted a church in downtown Cincinnati. And it grew to about, 40 adults. And but I was only in my early 20s and really not fit to be a pastor. Not that there's any moral stuff. It just didn't have the experience you needed. And I also was becoming increasingly reformed in my ecclesiology. So I came into kind of the deeper reform movement, not through sacramentology, but through ecclesiology. I think that's been something that's a little unique about me the more I've been around. Like, I wasn't obsessed about baptism or the Lord's Supper. But because I was a church planner and I was very interested in authority structures and who sends who and how that all works out, and who, if I'm telling people they have to submit to me and have membership, like, who am I submitting to? Who am I accountable? How's that all work out? Is there apostolic succession? If there's a break in apostolic succession, how's that work? You know, all that stuff. And so I actually decided to take a break. I unplanted the church. That was in 2008.
I've never heard that phrase, but that's an interesting.
And I just talked to
church. Yeah.
I just talked to a good friend of mine a couple of minutes before I hopped on here that apparently you just did a podcast with my friend Michael Clary. And Michael had just moved to Cincinnati. And so we sent some of our core group to his core group that was forming at the time into another PCA church. And then I decided I'd go get 3 years of training and come back. That 3 years turned into 10 years. I went to a Bible college. I went to seminary down in Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. Slowly became more and more confessional and Presbyterian in my commitments. And that's kind of how it happened. But I was part of that new Calvinism, but I was just a little bit before it really exploded. And I'm thankful that I came to my convictions by books and friends and not YouTube videos and PDFs and online arguments, because I think that would have shaped my culture a little bit differently.
Yeah. Something you said, you said that what you were frustrated by weak churches. And if we think about the, again, going back to the theme of good, bad, and ugly, do you think that's one of the good parts of Reformed culture, is that the reason it formed was because people were tired of weak churches and they wanted a more robust theology. They wanted a more robust ecclesiology. They wanted a more robust faith. Because I grew up in the 90s. You know, I was an 80s, 90s kid. Yeah. I remember, you know, do you ever see the movie Saved? I talk about this movie a lot.
I know what it is, but I wouldn't watch Christian movies. Like, that's a secular movie making fun of Christian youth groups with Mandy Moore. Is that the chick that's in it or something?
Yeah. Macaulay Culkin is a – yeah, gotcha. Yeah, Macaulay Culkin's in a wheelchair and Mandy Moore's in it. And it's all about how this – you know, the church sort of – if you're not a part of the church, you're not a part of the cool club. And I just remember one part in the movie where the youth pastor comes out and says, "Is everybody down with G-O-D?" And I remember thinking that was the most perfect representation of the 90s youth group culture of this sort of like, let's just turn the church into this clubhouse where it's this goofy acting and everybody's, you know, enamored with the band that, you know, is covering these Christian songs that are on the radio and everything. And this was what the youth group was. And then that became the church in the 2000s. So many churches were youth groups that grew up. And I talked to Michael about this. It's funny you mentioned him because his show is going to go out before yours. So people who keep up with the show, they'll have seen my show with him and then you. So that's great. But that weakness in the church, I think, was part of what drove the new Calvinism. I mean, would you agree with that? That's what many people were looking for?
Yeah, I think so. I think new Calvinism and old Calvinism, what they have in common is that they were very shaped by media. So the initial Reformation by the printing press, right? But new Calvinism was the advent of kind of social media 1.0, blogging, YouTube, and all that sort of stuff. That just hit with, like, Desiring God had all this free stuff. Guys like Driscoll knew really how to take advantage of that. You know, I was friends with some of the people that created the resurgence and all that. They're getting really kind of savvy in SEO. So I think suddenly there's, like, people, like, let's, instead of going to the library, they just went to the internet to look things up. And this content was there. So that was part of it. They're looking for something deeper. And it was the 90s is the very end of old America, right? It's the very end of it. It's the beginning of, like, 88, like, things like methylphenidate, Adderall, all that stuff had really hurt the boys. in the early 80s, it's still very rare to have divorced parents, but that like that exponentially changed to the 80s and the 90s. And then right when you come to early 2000s, that's the beginning of the epidemic of pornography. That's the beginning. Cell phone usage did something to young women that they there's a weird correlation between the I'd have to go get the stats on this between women adopting porn and having cell phones at that time. It's very weird correlation, but basically all this stuff like that has been building built up to that moment, or you had new technology coming out and it just created like a real chaotic time across the board. And that's where you get things like the emergent church, where they're saying like the early emergent church, which was really called the emerging church. If you go to like Alan Frost or something in the early days, it was like this sort of empty institutionalism. Is there something else? Like there's a book, The Shaping of Things to Come, I think. And, so early emerging guys were asking, like, is this all there is? And that was a great question. But there was guys like Brian McLaren and Rob Bell who were really snakes, right? They really didn't want the truth. Mm-hmm. But and as it would turn out, guys like Ed Stetzer, I think, kind of were trend riders and not the same level of snake, but I don't trust that man. But Driscoll was asking those questions. A lot of people were, and I was in that emerging church early on, but we were actually looking for answers. We're looking like, is there something? So we started to turn back to older things and Google guys like Jonathan Edwards or whatever. You Google Edwards back in that time, or cert Dogpile, Metacrawler, whatever you're using, you're going to find, you're going to find John Piper. And so I think it's all that stuff's going there. I don't know that the Reformed Church is as strong as they imagine they are, but it theologically, at least, was a move in the right direction that people are looking for something old or more robust.
Yeah. Yeah. So in your initial tweet, again, the one that kind of got me the thinking in this direction and thinking about what we were going to talk about, you did mention that the Reformed culture is nerds competing to prove who's the most hardcore. And this kind of goes back to what we just said. Okay, so there's this seeking of the robust for some people, not necessarily all. I think there's also a bandwagoning and trending that happened. You know, it was cool to be, Calvinistic because it's not my mom's way of doing it. It's not my Michael and I talked about, it's not my grandmother's church, right? We're doing it different. You know, it was another way of being different. But you said so much of Reformed culture is nerds competing to prove who's the most hardcore, truly Reformed. I fight that battle all the time. Well, let me back up. I don't fight the battle because I don't care, but I see the battle being fought all the time of people who are trying to determine who's really Reformed and who's not. Okay, R.C. Sproul is Reformed, but wait, he's not because he wasn't actually part of a presbytery or something. And I heard that, you know, that his church wasn't connected to this or something. And or this person, you know, is truly Reformed, but this one's not. And of course, John MacArthur's a dispensationalist, so he's out, and guys like me, I sit back, I say, I don't care what, you know, and that's why, honestly, people say, why do you use the word Calvinist? Because I think it's easier than Reformed. I think, Calvinism typically ties me to the 5 points of Calvinism, which I affirm.
Soteriology mostly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's not necessarily connected to some variation of covenant theology, which I would hold to and this is pretty well known. I'm more of a Wellam and Gentry progressive covenantal view. I don't really hold to classic covenantalism or Baptist covenant theology. It's more of a kind of an odd view, which is fine. You know, so what are your thoughts on, you know, why this is? You say, you know, hardcore, truly Reformed guys, they're just trying to move the bar and say, this is Reformed. You have to be this. Is it because they want to be part of an elite subculture? Is that what you think is what you meant by that?
So tomorrow is my 44th birthday. And, I bought myself a birthday gift on Amazon last night, and it was a 1994 Hildebrand Brothers Marvel Masterpiece card set, 300 cards. It's like, so I grew up in the comic book culture in the late 80s and early 90s, really the height of comic book culture in America. I can basically tell you any artists from that period of time just by looking at it. Like, I'm sure thousands of artists. I used to run a comic book store, and at one point I owned about a million comic books. And so I know everything there is about comic books. And that's a kind of a nerdy thing, right? And so when I use the word nerd, people are like, oh, he's using a pejorative. First off, stop being a wuss. But when we say nerd, we're talking about really people that are really into something, right? They know all that about that. And most guys I know have a nerdy side on something, right? And for me,
I don't know if you can see my wall. I'm a movie nerd. I love 80s and 90s movies. I would rather watch Jurassic Park than any new movie.
Yeah.
I would rather watch Back to the Future than any new movie.
Yep.
And Death of Superman was at 93. Death of Superman. Yep.
Dan Jurgens was the artist of that.
I have every comic book from that year, bought them off the stand, put them in the plastic myself, put them in my box. They're still in my box to this day. It's my one heirloom that I'm saving for my children. This is it. This is,
Then we thought that was going to be worth a lot of money, but it didn't work out that way.
Yeah.
Well,
they made 8 billion copies. So it was hard.
That's the thing, man. So nerds are people that are really into that. And nerds are really attracted to Reformed theology. It has a rich history. And there's so much to it, right? And I think what I've seen is, people don't understand how much variety there is. Take Bucer, Calvin, Bullinger, Zwingli, those guys. If you look at their view on the relationship between the state and the civil government, each of them have their own little picadillos or differences that are pretty significant that they're still working out. And so some people, like, that's their identity. Like, well, I'm more of a Bucer guy. I'm more of a bull, and these guys start arguing over like who is right, which is fine, but it becomes a feature of their personality. Like, I don't know, Deep Space Nine is much better than Star Trek Enterprise, right? Or
How dare you?
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Benjamin Sisko is certainly better than whatever Scott Bakula's character was.
I love Scott Bakula. I'm sorry. Necessary Roughness, one of my favorite movies of all time. Scott Bakula, I love him. So I have a soft place in my heart for him. Kirk or Picard?
I think, Picard can be such a white knight at times. I really like Picard at times, but I guess Kirk. It's gotta be Kirk, right? Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt your train of thought.
Yeah.
But
what I was going to say is that these guys, there's a nerdiness to it, right? Where they obsess over details. And so what happens then is that it's a competition to see who has mastered the most information and who knows all these varieties in the greatest way. Just like guys that, it's almost like hipsters when hipsters are arguing about music or whatever. Have you heard of this rare band or that rare band? And I've noticed this with guys I've watched. Like, for example, I remember when that Precept. Precept was a big deal. Everyone was like into
Precept. Hashtag Precept. Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone was crazy about it. And Precept then got super reduced down to a very simplistic usage of it. And then there was this kind of swing. And then everyone was a bunch of Thomists, right? They're all into Thomas Aquinas and they're arguing about it. And I looked at that and what I thought, and I saw a lot of the guys who were Thomists, and I'm like, I remember you being the Precept guy that was going on and on about it just a couple of years ago. Now you're talking about how Precept is bad and it's Kantian way of thinking and all this stuff. What if this is not actually as motivated by logic and reason and conviction? I'm not saying it isn't, but what if some of this is just motivated by being cooler, right? And like it's a correction, always being on the edge, man, always being on the fringe. And the example I give people is I knew quite a few people who went from being Ron Paul supporters to Bernie bros. Like, I knew quite a few, where I'm like, those are the opposites, guys. What do they have in common, though? What they have in common is they represent the fringe and they were cool to a certain outsider element, right? And so I think Reformed culture can play to the nerdiness of some people's personalities. It can play to the sort of hipster, I know this very obscure thing that you don't know, therefore I'm better than you. And then also it plays to this kind of youth fringe culture at some level. At least it has the last 20 so years. I didn't become a reformed like you really around the same time, maybe 2003-ish or whatever. But I don't know if what it was like in the 80s. I get the sense it was very small. But those things all create this sort of competitiveness and swirl of troublemaking and fighting over silly things. That, and I'm reformed. I'm a Presbyterian. I'm a Westminster guy. I think everyone should be Presbyterian. That's what I believe is right. What the Bible teaches. I love it. I teach that. But the subculture wars in the Reformed community are pretty, they're not attractive because a lot of them feel petty and like it's not about the truth. I don't know. That's how it comes across to me.
No, I think what you just said is right. And I'm taking notes as you're talking, because this is important. Your precept, you mentioning that, we have an academy at our church, and we teach a 2-year basic ministry training program where we have church history and apologetics and ethics and things like that, that we teach courses. And one of them, our apologetics course, I remember the first night of apologetics, there were some people who came in, man, hashtag precept, all this stuff, but they couldn't define it. They couldn't really define. I said, can you tell me what precept is? Well, it's presuppositionalism. Can you tell me what it means? Yeah. Well, it means, you know, what's the phrase they love to use? By what standard? That's what they think precept is to say by what standard. And I say, yeah, but how does this work out logically? How does this work out in how you understand what it means?
Have they read Bahnsen? Have they read Frame? Have they read Van Til? Do they know that there's differences between all three of those guys? Do they understand the Gordon Clark debates and all that stuff? They don't have to know all that to believe it, but just there's shades, right? There's a spectrum. There's even arguments. It's like postmillennialism. There's quite a bit of distinction inside of postmillennialism, like there would be amongst the pre-mill to some degree as well. But whatever people, why people, well, I don't want to get too far ahead of this, but here's what is very convenient about Calvinism and forms of Reformed theology. Because the minds behind it are very systematic minds and very clean minds, there is this ready to grab a hold of worldview for you. And instead of thinking deeply, you can just, it's all prepackaged for you. Now, I think there's something good about that. But I think if I don't have a strong view on something, I haven't thought it through, I just go with what the Westminster says. And people say, well, shouldn't you no, that's my default confession. I've thought through most of it. I've studied most of it. I could argue most of it from scripture. But when I'm not really sure, I'm like, I'm just going to go with these guys who I've agreed with on their summary of doctrine on most everything. I'm just going to go with them, but I'm going to put a little asterisk here. I haven't thought through this deeply, but I trust these men on these things. And this is where I'm going to hang my hat for the moment and I'll return to it. Right. I think that's like the right attitude when you come into that. But for some people, they just grab it and they argue, it becomes a personality for them. And then you will notice these people move from one thing to the next. Right. Cause it's really, they're unstable people or they're people without backgrounds. And that's why I think I've been thinking about, so I was talking about LARPing before anyone else was in the Reformed community. I can go back to that. The first tweet on it. And now LARPing's kind of run the whole gambit from being, yeah, everyone's LARPers to now like, hey, it may look like LARPing, but we're trying to get something figured out. So don't call us LARPers. It's been funny to watch the change of that. But if you think about this, when I look at folks that are really into role-playing games and really into, say, the Lord of the Rings, it could be because they appreciate tradition because they have a really rich familial religious tradition that they grew up in. That could be it. But often it's because they really don't have identity from their family or for their society or their culture, and they're looking for a tradition to pull from. They're trying to get some, you know, it's like when you're sliding on snow and you kind of pump the brakes so you can finally get the wheels to grab on something. I think people are like, I want to know who I am, where I belong, you know, and you have these worlds that you get enveloped in, and it gives you a sense of personhood and where you belong in things. I think some people come to the Reformed cultures and subcultures for that same reason, is that they just don't know who they are. And here's this thing that offers them a complete identity. And they're going on about the sort of minutiae of Cromwell's mistakes. And you're like, no one knows. And this is not just Reformed culture. And you take Calvary Chapel. In Calvary Chapel, when I came to Calvary Chapel, everyone was talking to you about the 60s and 70s hippie, you know, Jesus movement. And Chuck Smith wore, like, he actually didn't wear Hawaiian shirts when he preached. He actually always wore a suit, because I've been out there. But all these guys would wear these Hawaiian shirts and do this. Chuck Smith would go, "Well, you know." And he'd also say "glory" real slow. And you're hearing all these guys out in the Midwest that were, you know, listening to Maranatha music and Keith Green and Greg Laurie and all this stuff. And they would wear their Hawaiian t-shirts and talk like Chuck Smith. And then they would expect guys like me, some kid deep into Nirvana and Nine Inch Nails from the 90s, coming into this church to care about hippies. So now the barrier to entry to enter to this Calvary Chapel is I have to know all this stuff about the Haight-Ashbury revival. I have to know about, you know, it was a barrier to entry. The Reformed barrier to entry, especially in some groups, is so high. You got to be able to sing four-part harmony. And this one woman was telling me, like, well, if the guys don't know how to sing in four-part harmony, we'll just come over and teach them. Oh yeah, that won't be weird. And the guy, "Hey, excuse me, woman, I'm a visitor to your church. I don't know how to sing four-part harmony. Will you teach me?" That's never going to happen. Or if they've never been to a church where you up, down, up, down, up, down, where it's like, you know, sweating to the oldies sort of liturgy. These things are very, also if you use very technical language. I just preached a whole sermon on particular redemption. And I never said Calvinism or Arminianism, because my local farmer people here, they don't know what that stuff is. And I preached what Calvinists believe, what Reformed people believe, but I don't want to set this barrier to entry. And I think the Reformed, some people like a barrier to entry, because it's an identity, it's a club, it's a way to separate yourself from the lemmings, or however you want to look at it. And that's what I think I see in so many of these subculture wars. And it is really as a subculture, because it's not, I don't know that it's a counterculture. Like, it's got its own kind of power to it. It does feel like a derivative of what's going on in the main dialogue that you see. So, some thoughts.
It's interesting you mentioned LARPing, because you're right. That's been sort of an argument online. I haven't gotten into it, but you and I talked about that on the trip, because I said, you know, yeah, it seems like there are people who are taking traditionalism, like the trad wife movement. And I had to explain that to somebody the other day. I mentioned trad wife on a Wednesday night. Wednesday night at our church is more of a Bible study. It's very informal. And, you know, I still teach, but it's just a small group of people. Our church is spread out over Jacksonville. Jacksonville is huge. So our main gathering day is Sunday, and midweek it's hard for everybody to come, get off work on time and get there. So it's, you know, 20 people or so on a Wednesday night. So I get to talk about a few, you know, a little bit more relaxed on Wednesday. And so I mentioned the trad wife phenomenon, and not very many people had heard of it. And I said, you know, well, basically it's this, you know, it's wanting to have this tradition. It's wanting to tie back to something. I said, but it's a lot of it has to do with how you look and how you present yourself. And it almost comes out like LARPing. It almost comes out like a live action role play. For those who don't know what LARPing is, for our non-nerds who watch the show and don't know, have never heard that phrase, it just means it's like the guys who go out in the field You ever heard of SBA?
Vikings or something, or they've got their foam swords, and it actually looks like a really fun time. Frankly, I've never done it, but
yeah,
it could be fun.
I had a friend who was part of SCA, which is known as the Society for Creative Anachronism, and that was the group SCA, and they would go and dress up in these old clothing, but they would. It was so weird. And the name, Society for Creative Anachronism, is such a funny thing.
It's a nerdy thing.
They would go and,
yep.
Yeah. So, but, you know, that I think is an issue in and of itself, because it sort of makes our things that are important become things that we're playing at rather than things that we're taking seriously, things that we're doing as thoughts on that.
Well, so you're always going to have people who are doing what's cool or at the moment. Yeah. Okay. but let's think of like guys that are trying to dress a little nicer to show respect. Maybe their first attempt is just like really shiny button-up. It's just like over the top shirt. Like every guy is going to make fun of that guy. That's just what's going to happen because guys tease each other. But it could actually be a godly thing where he's like, you know, man, I don't dress in a respectful way when I'm in a more serious environment and I want to carry myself with a little more gravitas. And there's that sort of corrective time, right? Where you're figuring out. And so, a woman that like, I think about this woman that I knew, I was in a church that, was pro head coverings and you know, no contraceptive and all that sort of stuff. And this girl, she had entered into the church, and she was a piece of work, right? She was what a scripture would call a loud woman, but she was like, I'm not a feminist anymore. And she wouldn't ever wear pants. And she said, Mercy said to me, I don't wear pants. I don't think people should wear pants. There's only two types of pants. There's man pants and sexy pants. And I was like, that's not true. There's sexy man pants. but she was always, she had grown her hair out quite long, and she wore these very beautiful dresses. And I remember her posting these pinup pictures of redhead, light-skinned women all the time on her Facebook that kind of looked like her. And they always had a slightly erotic flavor to them. And then I Googled the name of the artist, and the artist was a famous pinup artist. Like literally, this was a guy that draw the pinup girls on the side of World War One or World War Two planes. And I was like, hey, I don't know if it's like really modest to be posting those things on Facebook because they kind of look like you and they're always kind of erotic. And she said, well, I'll take them down if they stumble you. I'm like, I'm not stumbled. I just think it doesn't look good for you. You know, that's all I'm saying, but whatever. But then that girl ends up having a falling out with the church. And next time I see her, she's wearing the tightest pants I've ever seen someone wear. Right. And I just thought like, okay, I'd rather women wear tighter pants and have a gentle and quiet spirit, because that will take care of it in the long run. I want them to have the substance. But I think there is a time where you're trying to, like, women that have been dressing in an immodest way are trying to figure out how to dress in a modest way. And just like a guy that's trying to dress better, it can come off a little ham-fisted and awkward. And some of them are fake, and some of it's momentarily. But for some of them, it is a sincere effort to be different than the direction our culture has gone. And that's why it's hard to have these conversations online, because they require, you know, discretion and discernment, right? And we've so reacted against nuance, because guys like Tim Keller used nuance to smuggle liberalism into the church. But nuance, there's a big difference between, I always tell people, the Bible says there is no God. It absolutely says that. It says the fool says in his heart there is no God, right? Like, nuance matters, man. And so I do think when we get to these topics of trad and LARPing, there should be a measure of grace. Because people are trying to find themselves, but some of it is just trying to be cool. It's just more of that.
Or, or in some ways find an identity. Like in the 90s, one of the big identities and that I noticed was the goth identity. Yeah. I never connected with that. You mentioned earlier, you mentioned being into Nine Inch Nails and Nirvana. Now I knew Nirvana because of Smells Like Teen Spirit, but that was all I knew. I didn't know, you know, Come As You Are, stuff like that, stuff that everybody knew, but I wasn't, I was a band nerd. I wore khakis and polos to school every day of my life because I was the biggest nerd. I carried a briefcase instead of a backpack. I was really, truly a nerd.
That's awesome.
And I didn't care. I was in the band. Football coach wanted me to play football because I was 6'2", you know, 250 pounds. He wanted me on the football team, but I wanted to march around with a baritone. That was what I wanted to do. And so I did it. And I, like I said, but I saw these people who found their identity in what they wore. And I guess I did too. I mean, I found, you know, like I said, polo, sure. I'm still wearing a polo shirt today. It just was who I was. And so, you know, there's nothing wrong with finding connection to an identity. You know, I guess the bigger concern I have is, are we doing it because that's truly who we want to be or truly who we are? Or are we doing it because we found a way to maybe make something be the way we hope it is? And you and I mm-hmm. talked a little bit about this on the phone about, you know, wanting to go back to a Little House on the Prairie style culture or something, you know, where it's, you know, it's wanting something that we didn't have. And like you said, my parents were divorced. My parents got a divorce when I was six, and that was the worst day. That was the worst time of my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would have given anything to not have my parents be a divorced parents. And even though I met my stepmom and she brought me to church, and it was because of her that I'm in the church I'm in now. So I can look back and see God's hand of providence in it. I can also take a step back and say, you know what, at the time I wanted it to be different. And when I got married 25 years ago, I told my wife, we're not getting a divorce. We're not doing that. Like, we're going to stay together until I'm dead or, you know, and I'm going to die first. I'm pretty sure I'm very committed to that.
So, you know, as part of this No, that's awesome. It was part of this too. Is so there's this Facebook Reels, I've fallen down an algorithm where it's the music from Donkey Kong Country where he rides the Marlin. It's this really throwback music, and but it's always like, here's what Pizza Hut used to look like, and here's what mm-hmm. library, and so it's this very nostalgic sort of thing, and it matches up with this is what they took from you, right? Like, that's kind of a line you'll see a lot on social media. And I did a podcast called Nostalgia is a Killer. It was an episode where I talked about the death of my brother 2 years ago, and the point I wanted to make is that with nostalgia, you can look back and only remember the good times and forget all the bad times, right? And the good times often are the highlights. And they're, you know, I love that I grew up without the internet. Like, I always tell my son, if I crapped my pants, you couldn't prove it. But nowadays, there's some kid with like a camera. Like there's a couple of kids. I remember this one kid my senior year, like, they would tease this guy. I didn't come to that school to eighth grade, but these guys grew up together. He's like, remember that time you crapped your pants in third grade? He's like, that never happened. And I think it did, but I couldn't prove it. But nowadays, there's like someone with a camera, right? So I love that I grew up in a time where, you know, the way you came home when the streetlights came on and all, it was like, I didn't know that the 90s was going to be this idyllic time, but it turned out to be a really decent time, actually, on the whole. But what I don't like that's happening right now to the younger generations is that I think they're being blackpilled, right? In other words, that they're getting really negative about where they are because everyone's like, it was awesome back then. And I remember I found this video. I don't know where I saw it, but it was like the year 2000, and it was just them walking around filming something at a high school, and like, look how happy they were. They had everything they ever wanted. And I was like, dude, that's like when people were shooting up schools. That's like Columbine and everything. I was around then. I was like, there was a lot of good things about that time, but I was looking at the kids in the comments talk about how awesome of a time it was. And I was like, what? So I think some of the trad wife, LARPing, all this is a reaching back to the past to try to stabilize, to hang on to something, to a happier time. And it's part of the failure of the church right now to cast a compelling vision for the future, which is probably why Christian nationalism is really popular talking point right now, is that it is at least a vision of some sort for the future. Whereas I don't know what would be another big pitch happening like that in culture right now. So I think some of the... that's what I think is going on a little bit.
It's interesting you mentioned that, and talking about Christian nationalism often, I know this is sort of a departure, but I think we can bring it back together. And that's the idea of postmillennialism. Postmillennialism gives that hope for a future. I'm going to quote James White here only in the sense that, this is what I heard him say. I don't remember when he said it, but basically he said what really tipped him in becoming post-mill, which I'm still a-mill, but he's post-mill, and you can try to convince me one day if you're post-mill, we can have that conversation. But he said when he had grandkids, he wanted to believe there's something, that there is a future and that there is something that you can look forward to, and not everything is going, as the proverb says, to hell in a handbasket, right? Like there's hope. So having grandkids helped him become post-mill, and myself, I as an a-mill guy who was like, no, don't go. I was like, I could poke holes in that from a purely debating perspective and say, well, that's your emotions talking, or that's your nostalgia talking, or your desire
or whatever. Yeah.
Sentimentalism. Yeah. But at the same time, I know why. I understand why I know each one of my children has brought a different perspective into my life. And my last son, Theodore, I was 42 years old when I had him. I call him the child of my old age. He's my Abraham child, and I see him and I have such a different perspective raising him than I did raising my other children, who are now 25 and he's one. I got a daughter who's 25. I got a son who's one, and I can, we're trying to help her get her life started and do the things that she's got to do versus, him literally getting his life started in a different way, and what's it going to be in 25 years? If I make it that long, I'm going to be 70 years old, and it's just an amazing thought that my son, when he's her age, I'm going to be that age. Again, you're so easy to talk to. I appreciate it. But do you think post-mill is kind of filling that need in people of having hope, I guess, is what I was getting around to saying.
So if you study history, those post-mill and pre-mill tend to track with things going on in society. I would say post-mill right now isn't, because things are going so bad, but usually it's like post-mill blows up as they move to America and they feel like this is a new city on the hill and then create this. Pre-mill takes off during pairs well with existentialism during World War II and just seeing what happened to Europe and how evil people could be. So I think a lot of times eschatology can really be about some sort of, like, for example, I think pre-mill really, anyone that loves the news loves kind of pre-trib, pre-mill eschatology, because now they can frame everything happening in the news as part of, like, it could bring peace to them. They don't have to be anxious. Oh, this is it. That's the Antichrist. That's the one world government. That's this, whatever. And they can justify their obsession with the news through eschatological lens or whatever. Post-mill, I think, is so fascinating to see how post-mill can be used, because I personally don't think post-mill has been a good predictor on productivity and a good predictor on who has spines. I think the guys in Moscow, they stood real strong the last couple of years on a lot of things. But I've known a lot of post-mill guys I've known a lot of post-mill guys who I call triple B post-mills, beans, bunkers, and bullets. And they're waiting for society to collapse so they can erect the king, like the glorious kingdom culture or whatever. And so they're like waiting. They're waiting for like the West to fail, and then that'll be their moment, right? And you're like, how different is that from the holy huddle of the pre-trib guys, right? That are like, it's all gonna burn anyway. So what's really interesting to me about theology is how much of it tends to be a function of our psychology and our cultural cultural concerns. I don't want to go too wild. Like, there's also rational biblical reasons that they're drawn to those things. But when you've been around a while and watch friends go through things and like go through their own theological journeys, I've had some friends that are like on a theological, like, we used to have those things that we all used to jump on and go as quick as possible. What do you call it? Merry-go-round. Theological merry-go-round. Yeah. They're like, they're Protestant and then they're like Lutheran, then they're Catholic, and then they've come back to their Protestant church. I'm like, it's just, they've kind of done this thing. Once you've watched people go, you're like, I don't know that this is all is as motivated by like purely rational biblical thought as you think. But I do think post-mill, for me, I am post-millennial, and because I believe that the Jesus is the head of the church. The church is his body. Jesus has a mission and Jesus can't fail. It's pretty simple. I think that he is the body. We are the body of Christ in this world. We're not disconnected from our head. Our head rules from heaven, and he's empowered the church to have a mission to make disciples of the nations. And he's going to accomplish it. But it's herky jerky. It's like the difference between AV and EV. So actual value versus expected value. So when you have a stock is expected to have this ROI on it, but it takes a while for the actual value, which can be crazy ups and downs, to level up to that eventual promised ROI. So I think church history is full of ups and downs, but there are more Christians than ever before across the globe, and more churches and more Bibles, and we're seeing things grow. So I believe that, but I think it's very clear that we're in a very dark time in our own country and in the West in general. But I'm confident that the Lord's working out his plan, but I think you could probably believe that and be pre-mill and all-mill as well. At least a lot of my friends believe that, you know. So
I was gonna say, as the self-proclaimed king of the amillennialist, I would say I agree with everything you just said.
Yeah,
I said to Doug Wilson when we had our conversation, I think there's so many, you know, I honestly, up to about 100 years ago, post-mill and all-mill weren't even really distinguished as far as language. I mean, it was just expectations, and then it became this sort of longer divide. I'm going to be talking about that this weekend. We're having our Bible conference, shameless plug, this recording will go out after. So I'm going to say our Bible conference went great, because I'm assuming that it will.
You can go watch it.
Yeah, that's right. Go watch our Bible conference. It's now on our church's website. But yeah, I mean, as an all-mill guy, like I said, I can affirm everything you said. And in many ways, I think, the distinctions are really just distinctions of expectation and what do we think is going to happen before Christ comes and finally, brings the consummation of the millennium that we both believe we're in, you know?
Yep.
And that was the thing that Doug and I both agreed. We're in the millennium. Christ comes to consummate the millennium, but we just don't know what's happening between now and then. And I would say maybe we're further into it than he does. I think he would say maybe we got couple of thousand years left to go. That's the case, yeah.
I always tell people amillennialism is eschatology for the people that are sick of eschatology. That used to be my take.
I'll take it.
Yeah. I was amillennial for a long time just because I was like, I don't want to talk about it anymore. That's probably closer to pan-millennialism, of course, but whatever.
Well, the guys at Eschatology Matters, they're the ones who, fortunately or unfortunately, you know, lopped me as the, you know, king of the amillennialists with their little poll they made. And it's caused me to have to speak on it more, where before I would never really talk much about it.
Yeah.
And now it's just become sort of this thing. But I'm glad, because it's caused me to have to at least be able to articulate better what I mean when I say certain things. And that's always good. God uses various ways to sanctify his people. So I'm thankful for that. But I want to, and I know we're at an hour mark, so maybe we can start kind of tying this up. But right above your tweet that was about the Reformed nerds and all that, you say this, and man, this speaks to me in a thousand different ways. But you said beautiful theology should not produce ugly hearts. This was the very next tweet after you said, you know, so much Reformed culture is competing to prove who's the most hardcore. And then you said beautiful theology should not produce ugly hearts. I would say I do believe Reformed theology is beautiful. I believe Calvinism and its expression of who God is, an expression of, you know, what God has done and the perfect saving work of the Lord Jesus Christ. I think that's beautiful. But I do think it has a tendency to produce ugly hearts. So for the last little bit of time here, I do want you to speak and be candid, you know, as fair as you can, but also, you know, what are the ugly things that we need to be addressing within our own camp, within our own, you know, as reformed. And I know it's not going to be unilateral. I know somebody out there would maybe say, well, that's not me. And if it's not you, it's not you. That's great. You know, I did a show with the IFB last week, three pastors from the IFB. The next day I had four IFB pastors reach out to me and say, those guys didn't represent us. And I said, well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to bring on guys who don't represent you. It wasn't my fault. I didn't know that they were part of a different sect of IFB. That was never my intention. So anything we say about the ugly, we know it's not everybody.
I'm happy they misrepresented everybody, and they can send all their direct messages and emails. I'll be sure not to respond. But so I think the biggest problem, in my opinion, is there is something about reform culture that allows people to get away with being theoreticians and living in the abstract and talking about great things and not doing much. And that there is a humility that's brought to life when you try to apply principles. So for example, if you read, there's a good book edited by Robert Kingdon on Calvin, marriage, sex, and family in Calvin's Geneva. And in I think it's the introduction that he talks about how Calvin became a principled pragmatist. And I would say that's what I am. I think everyone's a pragmatist. It's just, there should be an outworking of your principle. So I'm using that word in a very kind of generic way. But I love the intro because he talks about how once upon a time, Calvin would say a woman couldn't ever divorce her husband for the husband beating her. But as the woman came back before the session for the third time with a limp in her leg and a swollen eye, he started to rethink that stuff, right? And so you're really forced to walk out your principles and think through things. And so when you take Reformed theology, like everyone's an expert till they do something, right? Like I was watching this guy. He's like some sort of podcast host, and he's fairly built, talking to Nate Diaz. You think you could beat me in a street fight? And this guy's way bigger than Nate Diaz. Yeah, that dude would drop that guy like a bad habit, right? Like that guy is so disconnected. Him being big and strong, like I did boxing, wrestling, and mixed martial arts all through my teens into my early 20s. And if you know how to box, I don't care how big the guy is. As long as he doesn't get a good hold of you, you can just knock him out. He's never been punched like that before, you know? And so I learned how not tough I was. I remember going into this boxing gym, Shamrock's boxing gym in downtown Covington, and like hitting that speed bag, man. And your arms just get so swollen. And then that's like one round. You're not even done. Now you got to go hit the heart. And then you got to go hop in the ring and spar somebody. You barely lift your arms up, like they're aching. And then you think you're fast, right? You know, one, two. And then you do one, two again. And that dude knows you've telegraphed. He sees that he's going. So he throws he'll just come over top that right, knock you right out. And you're like, you're not tough. And that guy's like weighs like 50 pounds less than you. So here's the point. Like everyone's got a plan till they get punched in the mouth, right? The prophet Mike Tyson. And everyone has everything figured out on paper. But if you haven't executed on it at some level, you don't know, right? And I would just say it's like reform people and libertarians have a lot in common. Like libertarians are kind of pointless. I went through my libertarian phase and I like a lot of the things they have to say, but have they done anything? Like, what have they done? And I remember like these guys talking to me, what do you think about privatizing roads and parking lots? I'm like, I don't know, but I think it's not the issue that burns on my mind right now. And so when I look at the reformed people, they argue about all these things, but there are all these people arguing about abstract stuff. And if you go out there and try to do it, like I'll tell you, I can hold my own in a fight, but I know there are so many people tougher than me. I fought a guy in a mixed martial art match. I punched him as hard as I could. I kicked him right in his knee, man. I thought he was going down and nothing happened. And he tapped me out. That guy was Evander Holyfield's sparring partner for Tyson 2 when he got his ear bit. And that guy got beat up by Evander Holyfield. So the guy that couldn't stop Evander Holyfield, I couldn't stop him even. Right? Like, there's this whole nother levels out there. I know my place in this world. The best way for me to win a fight at this stage of my life is don't get involved in it. Right? And so you see all these cocky people. And I always think of that insult in the Old Testament. Look, don't put your armor on like the guy that takes it off. Right? You're putting it on, or you know, like, I've went out there, I've won the battle already. Go fight the battle a little bit. Go do some of that stuff. And it just, then you end up being way more gracious towards people. You know, it's easy to defeat. Like, I had a friend that got in an argument with a pre-mill guy that knew his stuff. And I was like, dude, there's pre-mill guys out there that are very thoughtful. They put a lot of time in that. And you're just arguing with people that haven't, you know, it's like Ben Shapiro beating up on freshmen sociology students. Right? Yeah. Oh, Ben Shapiro, yeah. That's really hard to do. So what? but you put that guy across someone that knows some stuff, and I've seen him wiggle quite a bit. And so I think with the Reformed world, a lot of the arrogance comes from being hearers of the word and not doers of the word. A lot of the arrogance comes from being very obsessed with the theoretical, which matters. Theory, principles matter. But God gives them to us to go apply into life, right? And that's why books like Proverbs or James right now are super helpful, good for the soul. The latter half of Ephesians, the latter half of Colossians and Galatians is the churches need to be hitting those wisdom books and those books that call people to actually apply that stuff. And that tempers that arrogance. And so that's another thing that's, I think, young people right now are obsessed about, in particular men, especially if they're impotent in real life. They are very interested in talking about authority that they can't wield, right? So if I were king for the day, I would make this perfect in the Christian nation. What would you do with homosexuals, or what would you do with this, or what would you do for that in this world that we're pretty far away from, like in terms of like, it's going to be a bit if that ends up playing that way. I kind of say, well, that's probably a good thought project, right? To work through, but I'm really just trying to figure out how can I get something done here where I live in Claremont County. And you just want to argue about all the theoretics. I'm curious, like, let's talk about what's your mayor's name, right? What's your county commissioner's name? Right. What's going on with the local school board? What are the issues coming up? What are the opportunities to reach your community? How can you bring the glories of Reformed theology to the people that are all right around you? And part of the problem that I have with Reformed subculture is that I woke up the other night because I had been sick for hours. And I slept for 10 hours and I woke up and I couldn't go back to sleep at 3 a.m. So I click on to X and I'm watching this YouTube streamer that is an acquaintance of mine beefing with this rapper because he made fun of the rapper's wife and said she looked like E.T. You know, yeah. It got real intense and they're fighting back and forth. And the one guy had 500,000 followers on Twitter and the other guy had 1.5 million on Twitter. And they're like using all this language that I didn't know what it all meant. And I hadn't even heard of the rapper. And I was like, I was laying there and I was thinking, here's two subcultures that are infinitely bigger than Reformed Christianity. And most people in my community wouldn't even understand what's going on there, right? And I think that's true also with Reformed subculture, is that if you adopt it, if you allow that to become the way you interact with people in your local community, a lot of them don't know what these words mean. They don't track these arguments. Twitter is like, you know, I think maybe 80 to 100,000 people are all listening to the same Reformed podcast. I don't think it's a large group of people think it is. I think it just feels that way. I don't think it's made the same impact that New Calvinism even made yet. I that's where I'm at right now. And if you adopt the subculture language, this insider language, part of the ugly is that you don't bring new blood in. You don't convert people to this robust theology. It stays a real small group. And then when your churches fail, it's because you're super spiritual. And they never consider whether it's you're socially obtuse and weird, you know.
Well, man, that's a lot to think about. And that's what you just said is really funny. People, when things fail, oftentimes, well, I was super spiritual. I was this, I was that. They weren't ready for me. Well, maybe you were just weird. Maybe you were just obtuse. Maybe
I was a bad communicator. My failures are my own, you know, they're my fault. And if they're my own, I can repent of them. And then there's hope.
Yeah. Well, Michael, thank you for coming on today, man. And I want to thank you publicly and personally for the other day. I really enjoyed our talk. I hope that we get to have another talk like that, you know, in the future and continue to remain friends. And I did get to see you personally at Fight Laugh Feast. Maybe I'll see you again at another conference soon. And you're in Cincinnati, right? Is that where you're?
Just outside of Cincinnati. Yeah, I can be downtown about 30 minutes. I tried to convince you that we knew each other when I met you at Fight Laugh Feast. I don't know if you remember that. You're really tired, but I was like, hey, how's it been, man? It's been a while. And tried to convince you that we hung out before.
I remember. I have a picture of the two of us. I was going to, I meant to bring it. Yeah. But I just thought I knew you from online, because a lot of people come up and they say, hey, man, and they'll talk to me. And I'm like, oh, well, we must know each other from Facebook.
We met at that party. You know, that's always fun to try to convince people. Yeah, dude, we went on a vacation together, our families.
Sorry. All right, one last question. This is a question I asked Michael Clary. I'll ask you as well. You're in Cincinnati. Is the chili good, or do you like it or not? The Cincinnati chili? Because I went there. We visited a couple years ago, and it's definitely not the chili that I grew up with. So are you a Cincinnati chili guy or not?
I am from Kansas City, Missouri. So I grew up where it's beans and meat, man. Watery cinnamon stuff, but my wife loves it and I love her. So I'm happy to buy it for her as much as she wants me to.
All right. Well, that sounds fair. That sounds fair. Well, Michael, I want to thank you again for being a part of the show, and come back anytime. We'd love to talk to you some more. And if people want to get a hold of you, they can find you at Michael Foster on Twitter. It went away on my phone, but what's your names and how people can reach out to you?
The handle is This Is Foster. So this is Foster, THISISFOSTER. And that's the easiest place to get a hold of me.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thanks again for coming on, man. I appreciate it.
God bless.
I want to thank you guys for being a part of the show today. I really appreciate you watching, and I hope you got something out of this podcast. Again, remember, if you're enjoying the show, please hit the thumbs up button. And if you're not enjoying the show, hit the thumbs down button twice. Also, don't forget to hit subscribe if you're watching this on YouTube, and share it around. It would really do good for that to happen. I want to also remind you that we are part of Sovereign Grace Family Church. So if you're in the Jacksonville area, come visit us at Sovereign Grace Family Church, sgfcjax.org. Thank you again for listening to Your Calvinist Podcast. My name is Keith Foskey, and as always, I've been your Calvinist. May God bless you.